a faded fragment of papyrus known as the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. Now, this is a fragment that is, about 4 or 5 inches long, about 3 or 4 inches tall. It's caused an uproar. Terrible. The Gospel of Jesus' Wife. Now, mind you, there's no such thing as a gospel. For those of you who are under the illusion that there is the gospel of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they didn't write gospels. Gospel is a made-up word. It was from an old English combination of two words. Gots spell is the basis of it. Got was the name of a pagan sun god in the Teutonic religion, and spell is what an occultist would cast on their prey. So there is no such thing as the gospel. So we start right there. Also, there's no such thing as Jesus. The name Jesus was not conceived until the 17th century. Now, so this is the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. So we know that the first two words of the three words that are there, forgetting the preposition for a moment, are errant. So, did Yosha have a wife? Uproar has been response to this, because it's a papyrus that is being promoted by the Harvard Divinity School. Now, by the way, most of the Harvard professors would be atheists. A few might be agnostics. But that would be the nature of the Harvard Divinity School. And it has been promoted by a historian there since 2012. Well, it has been tested by scientists, we're told, who conclude that in a journal published on Thursday, today, that the ink on the papyrus are very likely ancient and that it's not a modern forgery. Therefore, it must be true. I looked at the papyrus, and the first thing I noticed is there was not a placeholder for Yahusha. Therefore, it could not have come from the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, or even early 4th century, because every manuscript from that time has a placeholder for Yahusha. So, immediately I recognized that this Greek text was not ancient in the sense of it wasn't credible, and that what we find is that after Constantine rose to power and modeled a new religion after Mithras, his sun god, and created a politicized Christianity that grew into Roman Catholicism, that people changed the text willy-nilly, to use a scholastic term, and they had this propensity to write whatever they cared to write. And so, just immediately looking at it, I knew it was not a text that had any credibility. But I read more of the article. Skepticism about the tiny scrap of papyrus has been fierce because it contained a phrase never before seen in any piece of scripture. Now, for them to take the stance that this is scripture, and what they mean by scripture is not just a Latin word, which means writing, but they mean scripture, capital S, inspired by God. And so they're claiming that this is a scripture inspired by God. It says, Jesus said to them, my wife. Well, first of all, there is no Jesus. So it wasn't Jesus said to them. And it isn't scripture. It isn't even old. Too convenient for some, it also contained the words, she will be able to be my disciple, a clause that inflamed the debate in some churches over whether women should be allowed to be priests. The papyrus fragment has now been analyzed by professors of electrical engineering. that's if I wanted to date an ancient document, that's the first people I would go to. I would go to professors of electrical engineering. Chemistry and biology at Columbia University, Harvard University, and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who report that it resembles other ancient papyri from the 4th to 8th centuries. scientists at the University of Arizona who dated the fragment to the centuries before the birth of of Jesus concluded that their results were unreliable. So the University of Arizona, which is best noted for their study of the sun, was that would be S-U-N. were not considered reliable. Folks, there is a way to date papyrus fragments. And you can't date them by doing carbon-14 on the papyrus themselves, because many of the when papyrus was woven into a writing codex, it was typically written over. In other words, the papyrus usually was written on several times because it was such a valuable thing and a commodity in those days. And so the only thing you can do is you look at the calligraphy. You look at the handwriting. And you analyze the handwriting. And there's an entire science now devoted to analyzing handwriting to determine the time and the place that something was written. Of course, they didn't do that. And that would have been the way to date it. But they didn't do that. But even in their dating, 4th to 8th century was the composite, and that's so far removed. That comes to a time when there were all sorts of writings that were influenced by Roman Catholicism that just went into the netherworld in terms of accuracy.
Well, yeah, it could be one of the earliest Merovingian writings. You know, the Merovingians
yeah,
more than that.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, there's a stone that Mormons love to pass around that is written in Paleo Hebrew. The only problem is that every attempt to date the carving in the stone and it shows it to be a fraud, but let's not let the facts get in the way.
Nonetheless,
yeah.
Yes, yeah. Where he married Mary Magdalene or whatever. Yeah.
Yes, of course. Yes, it's amazing that a story like that would even get credibility. It wouldn't begin by saying, they didn't have, rather than having this dated in the only way that is considered legitimate. The only manner that is credible. They sent this instead to engineers in chemistry and electrical engineers at places like MIT. And they came to the conclusion that it was written in the 4th to 8th centuries, with the exception of the University of Arizona, which said it was written before the modern era. Come on, folks. Be credible. I mean, if you're going to write a story about something, begin with some basis, a foundation under which somebody could evaluate whether or not this has any merit. And rather than this story saying, well, then maybe there Jesus had a wife, shouldn't it say, well, you know, there is absolute evidence here that this isn't credible? Shouldn't it begin by saying, you know, one thing that differentiates this from any of the 69 manuscripts that have been found that clearly indicate that Yahusha was his name and that he didn't have a wife, differentiates because it wasn't written with the divine placeholders? A little research, a little thought would go a long way in terms of trying to educate people so that we just don't pass on such ridiculous rubbish. Speaking of ridiculous rubbish, there's a lot of people who are advocating the notion that you ought not vote because the voting systems in America are corrupt, that there are all sorts of fraud in the voting mechanisms. Now, I advocate not voting because you ought not associate yourself with the lesser of two evils, because it's very difficult, first of all, to even determine who the lesser of two evils is in most cases, and evil is evil. You ought not associate yourself with evil. I strongly suggest that you don't vote. But here's a report out of North Carolina. Election officials in North Carolina are investigating hundreds of cases of potential voter fraud after identifying thousands of registered voters with personal information matching those who voted in other states in 2012. Elections Director Kim Strach told state lawmakers at an oversight hearing Wednesday that her staff has identified 765 registered North Carolina voters who appear to have cast ballots in two different states during the 2012 presidential election. She said that the first names, the last names, the birth dates, and the last four digits of their Social Security numbers match. And yet, these same individuals, 765, are shown having voted in two different states during the last election. WRAL, which is a media site, reported that 81 residents who actually died before Election Day were also recorded as casting a ballot. We have the Walking Dead, and we've got the Voting Dead, said Senator Bob Rucho.
Like resurrection to me.
Yeah, I guess I'm wrong. There must be bodily resurrection after all. The counterproductive must somehow work. Maybe there's a reason that there's so much interest in zombie movies today. Maybe it's real. I'm surprised that the journalistic coverage didn't move into the potential for zombieism being a reason that this is occurring, as opposed to those most deeply engaged in politics being dishonest. Machiavellian, the ends justify the means. We needed to have change we could believe in. You know, it reminds me, we talk about North Carolina and Virginia, what happened during an election that back in the time that I was still political. In fact, this was probably the end of me being political. I was very close to Jerry Falwell at the time, and I had met George W. Bush and was just appalled by him. I mean, I was just horrified in my meeting with George W. Bush. And so I was looking for a candidate that, you know, maybe had a little more character going for him, and I had dinner shortly thereafter with Henry Kissinger, and I saw us talking to Henry Kissinger. Yeah, I know. I'm not fond of Henry Kissinger either. I said this was during a time that I was still political. It's interesting though that Henry Kissinger during the meeting, and we spent quite some time together. Even wrote a personal note at the end of the dinner that we had together. But Henry Kissinger said, you know, that the person that he was going to support was John McCain. And so I came to know John McCain personally. I had him invited him to my home. We spent considerable time together. It was a different John McCain than we witnessed today as John McClown from Arizona. But I will tell a story about what happened to him in his election bed against George W. Bush. Welcome back to Saturday Mess. I was telling this story of how back in the days that I was religious and political and therefore was incapable of exercising good judgment. I became active supporting John McCain in his bid for the Republican nomination over George W. Bush, and that I'd gotten to know both men. And during that period of time, John McCain was just eating George Bush up alive. It was a man against a boy. It wasn't even close. And he had a huge lead over George W. Bush, even though George W. Bush was obviously the favorite of the Republican conservatives and the Republican Party, because John McCain was considered a moderate at the time. And what happened is interesting, and it was Jerry Falwell that shared with me the insights into this. All of a sudden, just the air came out of John McCain's campaign. He went from trouncing George W. Bush to getting trounced in the primaries that took place in Virginia and North Carolina. And it's the reference here to North Carolina is what reminded me of it. And the voting in North Carolina reminded me of it. What the Christian Coalition did, Ralph is the guy's name, and I've met with him several times, too. I've forgotten what Ralph's last name was, but he created an organization called the Christian Coalition, and Jerry Falwell had the moral majority to literally integrate conservative republicanism and evangelical Christianity was the purpose, so that religion and politics were melded into one concept. And what they did collectively is they put out flyers on the windshield of everyone who went to church and the church parking lots right before the primary, immediately before the primary in Virginia and North Carolina between George W. Bush and John McCain. And what the flyer said is that the African-American child that was had been adopted by John McCain was the product really of an illicit affair that he had with one of his staffers, and went on to describe how this girl was born in John McCain's illicit affair. Now, the Christian Coalition and the Moral Majority, Ralph and Jerry, both knew it was a complete lie, that there was no substance to it whatsoever. But by promoting the lie amongst the gullible who had mixed religion and politics together, they prevailed, and George W. Bush not only won that primary, but it was over from that point on. And I saw what happens when politics and religion are integrated. And it was that moment that I began to say, why am I? Why am I political? Why am I religious? I don't want any association with this kind of stuff. And it was that was the beginning of me walking away from it. But there's a lot of fraud out there, my friends. And it's not just the fraud that takes place in those voting machines and in people casting votes on behalf of the dead and casting, as they used to say in Chicago, vote and vote often. We have a serious problem. And the best possible advice I can give anyone who is aware of how much malfeasance exists in politics today is don't vote. Don't participate. Don't align yourself with whom you think might be the lesser of two evils. Both sides are evil.
Yeah. Ralph Reed was the guy.
Ralph Reed, yeah. That's right. Yeah, Ralph Reed. Yes. Ralph Reed, once back in my political days, met with me several times, and I should have remembered his last name, but you're correct. One time I was considered for politics by those in politics, and Ralph Reed wanted to prepare me to run. And then as I was exposed to this, I just became repulsed and said, you know, if this is how they play the game, I don't want to play.
Yeah, I experienced similar disillusionment when John Ashcroft manifested such corruption under the Bush administration.
Yes.
John Ashcroft, I don't remember if his father or his grandfather was the president of the Christian college I attended. And they were very big exponents in that denomination.
Yep, it is. I had a reason to meet with Ken Starr, was another one of those individuals that has a political infamy. He was the judge over the Watergate affairs of Bill Clinton, that Bill Clinton smeared so readily and easily, and coming to engage in a matter of great significance to me and my family with Ken Starr, who is now the president of Baylor University. I can see why Bill Clinton was so easily able to malign him. And it's the people that engage in politics in this country are really slimy. There is occasionally an item in the news that I find funny. This one I find hilarious. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov on the issue of Crimea. So he is the deputy foreign minister for Russia, for the Russian Federation. And he is speaking on the issue of Crimea. He told the Interfax news agency, quote, "What can we advise our American colleagues to do? Should they spend more time in the open? Should they practice yoga? Should they stick to food combining diets? Maybe watch some comedy sketch shows on TV. This would be better than winding oneself up and winding others up, knowing that the ship has already sailed. Tantrums and weeping and hysteria just won't help." That's hilarious. What do you mean? He's right. that American politicians are having a conniption fit over Canary, over Crimea. We have sent a destroyer, a missile carrier, a guided missile launch system, a destroyer, into the Black Sea. We have sent countless F-15s and F-16 warplanes into what used to be Warsaw Pact nations. We're doing maneuvers around the world. We have NATO lecturing Russia now. We have put all sorts of sanctions on Russia for doing something that hasn't been done in a long time, and that is allowing people to choose which country they would be they'd like to be allied with, and accomplishing that without firing a shot. And we're having a tizzy fit. We're pushing every button that could lead to war. And what are the Russians saying? Oh, come on. What can I advise you to do? Spend some time out in the open. Yeah, take a look around. You know, stop hiding in the shadows and pretending that the world is so different than it actually is. Practice some yoga. Try to improve your diet. Maybe watch some comedy sketches. Just stop winding yourself up and winding everybody else up. The ship on Crimea has already sailed. Now, you look at the Ukraine. Right now, there are in many, many cities across the eastern Ukraine, not just in one city, in many cities, there's peaceful protests and occupation of buildings by ethnic Russians. Those who don't want to be part of the mob rule that took over Kiev. Now, in Kiev, the protesters, the Ukrainian protesters, the anti-Russian protesters, were allowed to camp out and protest for month upon month. They camped out in Kiev for, well, I guess it started in, what, October? And they continued to camp out through January for months. They occupied buildings. They threw Molotov cocktails. They were only fired at when they started firing at the police that were surrounding them. And the police only surrounded them on the buildings once they started throwing Molotov cocktails and occupying government buildings. But in the other cities now, and the way that America reacted to all of that was to applaud the protesters and to condemn the government. Now you have the opposite side. Now in the eastern Ukraine, you have ethnic Russians protesting against this cobbled-together coup of a government. And what did the government of the rioters and Kiev do? First day. Not only send in the police, they sent in the military to disband them. The military. Now, they had been allowed to camp out and protest for months. And we're talking about them expressing the will of the people. And then when people who have a different view protest for a day, they send in the military. And the West, the United States, is enriching this government with $25 billion, who responds to the very action that they were allowed to do with military force after one day. And just pure hypocrisy. Can't we put the pieces together? Why isn't there a voice in Washington saying, well, this is not right? This is pure hypocrisy. You can't do that. Why are we on one side of this when the side that we're on is, like everything that we seem to do in the United States, the wrong side? The silence here is amazing. Many of you may know that, and in fact I've mentioned it on the show, that Israel has canceled the release of a fourth group of Palestinian prisoners. They released three groups. And during the time, they released three groups of Palestinian prisoners, and none of the prisoners that they held were political prisoners, not a single one of them. Not a single one of them was a religious prisoner. Every one of them had been tried in what is an extraordinarily fair judicial system. and had been convicted for perpetrating acts of either terrorism or murder. All of them. And the United States decided, you know, the way that we're going to make peace with the mythical people known as the Palestinians and reward them with their own country is to release, have Israel release those it has convicted of murder. That's the way we do it. And so Israel, just in this most recent round negotiated by the United States, released hundreds of Muslim murderers. And during this time, the first three releases, the so-called Palestinians are reneging on their obligations in the agreement. And so the Israelis finally says, no, no, no. The fourth round, these are the most heinous Islamic terrorists. We can't release them. I mean, if we release them, where's our conscience? Where's our soul? Where's any sense of moral right? And they didn't. And yet, the United States is saying that's not helpful. It's not helpful to peace if you don't release murderers. And the United States, at the State Department level and at the presidential level, tongue-lashed the Israelis for not releasing more murderers. In recent days, the U.S. had reported that it had been trying to broker the deal and to extend the peace talks, but they were called off because Israel was not willing to release more murderers. The releases of the three previous releases of Palestinian prisoners were deeply unpopular with the Israeli public because most of those who had been freed had been convicted of murdering Israelis. But the Palestinians, many of whom regard the prisoners as heroes, yes, a murdering hero, only in a religion as corrupt as Islam, is that possible? Believe the final batch of prisoners would be freed under a U.S. deal that got the talks started last year. Secretary of State Kerry came back because his peace attempt failed. And it was obvious it was going to fail because the divestiture of Israeli land to the level that Kerry was proposing isn't going to take place until just before the final Islamic assault of Israel. And it bridges the tribulation. And so since it's the bridge to the tribulation, we know that it's premature for that to occur, and it didn't occur. He failed. You could read Yeshaya 17, and you'd know that he was going to fail, and that he should fail, and he did fail. But when he came back, he says, you know, I realized that this failed and that it wasn't achievable, not because the so-called Palestinians are mass murderers, not because they're ruthless terrorists, not because they have never honored any agreement that has ever been made with them in their brief history, not because they're comprised of three terrorist groups, one called Fatah, one called the PLO, and one called Hamas, not because Hamas is shooting rockets into Israel and that's how they responded to the last gift of land of giving them Gaza. Not because everything that we had done with regard to this situation had blown up in our faces and turned out to be regrettable. No, that wasn't the reason. He says, I knew it was over when Israel authorized the building of homes in Jerusalem. That was the crime. That was the situation that could not be reversed. It was the thing that cratered Kerry's plan, building homes. Now, building homes on land that was owned by Israelis, that didn't matter. Building land on the historical capital of Yisrael, the home of Yehudim, of Jews, that didn't matter. Building land that was captured as a result of an aggressor trying to destroy the country. That didn't matter. The fact that they were building homes, which is considered a worthwhile and good thing to do, didn't matter. taking care of their own people, being responsible. That didn't matter. It was okay for Muslims to fire rockets and to kill Jews and to perpetrate grotesque acts of terrorism. But you build a home in your historic capital on land that you own, and that is not conducive to peace. I mean, I don't know what to say other than if you're not repulsed by your government, then perhaps you've lost the ability to be moral, to be rational, to be sane. This from the Associated Press. Washington is the dateline. The federal government last week reached a $5.15 billion settlement with the Anadarko Petroleum Corporation. It was the largest ever for environmental contamination. It was designed to settle claims to clean up thousands of sites tainted with hazardous chemicals for decades. Kerr McGee owns the company. They are a mining company. The reason I bring this to your attention is that the United States recently sued an international court, the Chinese, demanding that they pollute their country to provide the West with the rare earth metals that it desires. Yes, the hypocrisy of this story is amazing. The federal government coerced Kerr McGee, which is essentially a mining company, to cough up over $5 billion because it claims that they polluted an area around Lake Mead with rocket fuel, leaving behind radioactive waste piles. Now, mind you, you only make rocket fuel for the U.S. government, and you only mine uranium on behalf of the U.S. government. So they were working for the U.S. government, giving U.S. government two products. They wanted one, rocket fuel. The other was uranium. And for that, they're being fined $5 billion, which is just say to anybody in the mining business in the United States, stop. The government is going to confiscate everything you worked for. So don't do it. But what's amazing about this is that China diminished by 40% the amount of shipments of rare earth metals. Now, these are rare earth metals that China has a 90% lock on. 90% of the rare earth metals that are absolutely essential now in most technology, from everything from computers and cell phones, the materials that are used in them, to spacecraft and aircraft. Use these same materials that are 90% of which are in China. And the mechanisms that are required to mine these are extraordinarily unfriendly environmentally. I mean, they're huge strip mines with lots of chemicals that are used to leach out these rare earth elements. And so China said, you know, we just can't be raping our land. This is inappropriate. And so the United States, which has a huge thirst for these rare earth elements, particularly for its military, sued China in the international court and says, you don't have any right to claim environmental protection as a reason of not giving us what we want. And they won. The international court sided with the United States and said, you know, China's not playing fair. It has to provide these rare earth elements to anyone who wants them, to any amount that is wanted, regardless of the devastation to its own country. Now, mind you, the international court has no control over China, and all that the West can do is impose sanctions, which means that they'll get less of what they want. But think of the hypocrisy of this. You sue China successfully in the international court, saying that they have to pollute their country, rape their land, to give you the materials you crave for your military, while you're threatening them with your military, and then you sue and reach a settlement with an American mining company that made products that mine products that were only for government, and you impose a $5 billion fine on them. That does one hand not know what the other hand is doing? Do the people no longer care that we're utter and complete hypocrites? That's astonishing how bad it's become and how much of this news just goes reported. This was Associated Press without anybody bothering to make the connection between these kinds of events. But it is through making connections that we understand. If no matter how much knowledge a person has, you know, we talked about academia earlier. In academia, people have knowledge of a particular field. But it doesn't matter how much knowledge you have. If you don't understand, if you can't make connections, if you can't exercise good judgment as it relates to that knowledge, then you are smart but stupid all at the same time. Yeah, you're smart in your particular field, but overall in terms of understanding, you're foolish. And that's what's happened to us. Here are the Associated Press, who reported on the international case as it relates to China and China's defense on the rare earth metals, now presents this and can't put the pieces together. And if you can't do that, you don't understand. If you don't understand, then you've squandered free will. So whatever freedoms you may have had, you've squandered them. And you put people in a position where they can easily abuse you. And you have no one to blame but yourself. This is why God said, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, for lack of understanding. My people are destroyed. They will cease to exist because they're ignorant, because they're irrational. That is what we strive to fight on this program. That's why we strive to make these connections. We want you to understand so that you can exercise good judgment and choose who to rely on and who to trust.